You are listening to Leaders and Legends, a podcast featuring some of Indiana's most fascinating men and women whose impact has shaped our state, our communities, and us. Join us as we discuss their imprint on our history. Leaders and Legends is brought to you by Veteran Strategies Incorporated, your local veteran business enterprise specializing in public relations, media relations, public outreach, crisis communications, and digital photography. My name is Robert Bain, Principal of Veteran Strategies, former Deputy Chief of Staff to Mayor Greg Ballard, and Communications Director for the Indiana Republican Party. I'm honored to be your host for our discussion. You are listening to Leaders and Legends, a podcast presented by Veteran Strategies, a local veteran public relations enterprise, and sponsored by Girl Scouts of Central Indiana, the Crown Plaza at Union Station, and McAllister Machinery, your friendly neighborhood Caterpillar dealer. I'm your host, Robert Vain, Principal of Veteran Strategies, and we are here with two former mayoral chiefs of staff, Mike O'Connor, Chief of Staff under Mayor Bart Peterson, and Paul Okeson, Chief of Staff under Mayor Greg Ballard. And incidentally, each one of these fine young men have been my boss at one time or another. Mr. O'Connor currently as president of the IPS school board, and I worked for Paul when I worked for Mayor Ballard. Thank you, guys.
Good afternoon.
Happy to be here. Apparently, you can't work for either one of us. Right. Must be the horrible boss.
There's two great ironies there. You and I are participating in something called Leaders and Legends, and I'm not sure which one either of us
either,
are.
Either category.
And that he can't keep a job long enough to work for either of us for very long.
That's true, although I have to say that Okeson at least spent about $150 in Patashew breakfasts to get me to work for him.
Went through a lot of broken yolk sandwiches with that guy.
It is a great thrill to be with two people I truly, truly admire, and admire them for their leadership and all that they've accomplished. And we'll let Mr. O'Connor go first because he's an Eastsider. And Mike, talk a little bit about how you got to be chief of staff and your life up to that point.
Well, it's an interesting story that I'll try to condense down to just a couple minutes. But Bart Peterson and I had worked together in the Bi administration. And then I went off to Washington, D.C., and I was working as an associate administrator at EPA. My wife and I had just gotten married, and I was coming back and forth. And at some point during the travel back and forth, my wife informed me that she would not be moving to Washington, D.C., which informed me that I needed to get a new job. right. And so literally that was a Sunday evening before I flew out on a Monday morning. And that Monday afternoon, I was sitting in my office in Washington, D.C., and the phone rang, and it was Bart Peterson. And he said, "Hey, I'm going to announce this week I'm running for mayor." And I said, "Well, that's great. You know, you bring the right temperament, vision. You know, that's a great thing." And he said, "Oh, well, there's a second part to this, and I'd like you to move back to Indianapolis and run the campaign. And then if we're successful, come into the mayor's office with me." And so...
And what was your campaign experience before then?
Well, I'd run several congressional campaigns. I'd run a statewide campaign for Secretary of State.
Joe Hogsett's?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Also ran Joe Hogsett's unsuccessful campaign for the U.S. Senate. Hogsett always says everybody claims the Secretary of State's race and nobody claims the U.S. Senate race, which went down in flames early. And just some other local races, those sort of things. But involved in political organizations and sort of at the ground level of a lot of political efforts.
Is it possible for you to come back for a separate podcast on all the things that Ann Mullen O'Connor has told you you're going to do and all the things she said she's not going to do?
You're probably going to need about an hour and a half for that.
We'd love to have
that. Would Ann still Mullen be an abridged O'Connor version.
Paul, go ahead.
Oh, I, you know, my, most people know my older brother, John, was in politics, and it was sort of in our family DNA, the things we talked about at the dinner table at night. And, you know, moved down to Indianapolis from Fort Wayne and really felt like I was in the internet world and really felt like I wanted to do something a little bit more constructive with my day and leave something a little bit more tangible behind than just selling internet space. And so I kind of worked my way into some local campaigns. I helped Peter Pizarro, who ran an unsuccessful bid for city county council. And from there, went and helped out on the Mitch Daniels campaign as a volunteer. And then as he took office, transitioned into the organization. you know, John used to give me pretty good advice. And
John was a statewide elected official.
Yeah, when he was only 29 years old. Clerk of the court? 94, yeah, back when clerk was still an elected position. And so he kind of encouraged me to get involved and hooked me up with a couple of different people. And along the way, I got to meet our current governor, Eric Holcomb, and became sort of close friends with him and took some guidance between he and John as to how to navigate those waters. And I did a brief stint at the state house for the governor. And then Eric came to me and asked me if I would go down and help out Todd Rokita and be his chief of staff as Heather was leaving. So
Heather Willis-Neal was leaving, yeah. and Todd Rokita was secretary of state. So you both have kind of secretary of state tie. Yeah.
And as
that guarding that seal's hard.
Well, well, you got to feed it a lot of fish, yes, as they
exactly
say.
Right. Boom, boom.
But you know, that was ironically a quick sidebar. Bill Moreau, I had a chance to sit with him while I was still in that office, and he looked at me and said, "You know, that's the best office in the state."
The chief staff office in the Secretary of State's office is the best office in the State House.
I mean, you have not so much to look forward to, so you embrace the little things.
It's a boring
right?
job, but it's a great office.
And so I left there. You know, the intention was that I would consider running, and I disabused myself of that after 2.5 years there.
Running for Secretary of State.
Yeah. And
could have really saved us a lot of trouble, Paul.
I probably the best decision I ever made, though, was right. Was
no offense,
not
Charlie.
To run. So, and then, of course, I spent all of 90 days in the private sector, and Mayor Ballard, Greg Ballard, this virtual unknown, wins, and I jump on the transition team, want to be helpful, and the rest is kind of history. You know, Joe Loftus put me into the Joe Loftus death grip over breakfast, and next thing I know, I'm inside the city-county building.
Well, and I remember, as the press secretary for the Ballard transition team, your news conference,
yeah.
when you were announced at the Christomore House.
That's right.
As chief of staff.
Well, you would remember. I think you kind of orchestrated the whole thing.
Maybe. You and Nick Weber and Algin, and there were some others, I think, who were announced at the same time.
I think Cotterill was.
I think that's right.
Corporation Council, yeah.
Mike, you're from Greenfield, as I recall.
Yes.
And Paul is from Fort Wayne. How did coming to Indianapolis change your life and career, Mike?
Well, I came to Indianapolis working for the Biden administration. I had been commuting back and forth, Greenfield's, there's 100, we're sitting at Lilly today. There's 1,000 people who probably commute from Greenfield today.
Oh, yeah.
But I wanted to be closer.
I work here.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It just kind of fell into, living in Irvington and as you know, being an Irvington native, it's a neighborhood that just kind of reaches out and grabs you, and it has both some wonderful, you know, community elements to it. It has just enough funkiness to it that things you see on almost a daily basis you might not see elsewhere in the city of Indianapolis. And so, at any rate, I grew up in Greenfield. Both of my parents are very active Democrats. May have been the only two Democrats in Greenfield. So it did create opportunities as a political hack residing in Indianapolis that didn't otherwise exist.
Do you remember your first kind of political event or moment or when you decided, wow, I'd really like to do this for a living or like to be active, for lack of a better term?
Yeah, I actually worked for a guy, Phil Sharp, congressman out of the Muncie area. He'd been a professor at Ball State. And I remember I working on that campaign, and I spent a lot of time traveling the district with him. And it's where, you know, I think in the end, those folks who want to be involved in government and politics, you're in it, I hope, because you really do get sort of at the ground level to help people. And I saw this connection. Phil, who is still alive and doing great things in the energy area, but was a policy wonk. But I saw him engage in areas like Anderson and Muncie and Columbus and others in a way that when somebody needed something, they knew they could go to Phil Sharp and he would figure out a way to help them. And it was just sort of this, you know, and I got my opportunity to live in Washington, D.C. for the first time. And, you know, sort of you walk from the Capitol South subway and you look up and you see the dome of the Capitol. You're like, oh, this is kind of a cool place. I'd like to spend more time here. Fortunately, a little more exposure to the federal government, and I learned that really I didn't want to spend much time in Washington, D.C. But it was just, I remember that. I remember traveling mostly a summer, traveling around the district with him and really sort of, this is what I want to do.
I never thought, and we'll skip ahead a little bit, but because I want to ask Paul, and Paul, I'm going to express a sentiment that perhaps applies to all three of us for different reasons. I never thought I would have the opportunity to work for the mayor of Indianapolis. Because after Bart Peterson won in 99, I quite frankly figured that, I love you, Mike, I figured you'd be the next mayor after Bart.
Yeah. You didn't figure we'd screw it up bad enough that well, somebody else could snip in.
I'm flustered now. No, I just figured there was a lock coming. Mm-hmm. And I never thought I'd have a chance. You may have felt the same thing because of 32 years of Republican mayors. So, Mike and Paul, talk at your leisure about the fact that you've been presented, you were presented at one time with an opportunity that perhaps you never thought that you would have.
Did you start? I just finished a minute ago.
Well, it is a good question. I think I may have alluded to it in my opening remarks about leaving the State House, but I worked for Lockmuir Engineering, ran their Indianapolis operation for exactly 90 days. I remember driving.
It was the best 90 days they ever had.
Well, and I think they would agree. No, I'm just kidding. But I remember driving down and talking to Keith Lockmuir, who is a man I will forever respect. Extremely generous man and smart and giving to his community and understood stewardship and public service. And I got about halfway through my speech and he just waved his hand. He said, "Son, Paul, I get it. You might never have this chance again in your life. You got to take it. You got to go do it. Don't worry about us. We'll be fine. You know, just knock on our door someday when you get done and keep us in mind." And that conversation was kind of a moment where I realized how special this really was. And I was just thinking about this the other day, looking at my calendar about this podcast and how many different people were considered for those jobs and how in the world did I end up in that seat is something that just has started to dawn on me in later years, like, wow, that was kind of like winning the lottery.
And one of the differences, I think,
or maybe being sentenced to jail, depending on your view.
Depending.
Is it on the hour?
Right. You had a relationship, a friendly relationship, and knew we're almost colleagues in a way with Bart, and like Joe Hogg said, in the bi world. How soon before Ballard won in 7 did you actually meet him or know him?
Well, those are qualifying and different questions, right? I met him a half a dozen times, but we didn't know each other. I mean, he wouldn't have remembered me walking up to him, because I'm sure in that blitz of those half a dozen meetings, he met hundreds of thousands of people, right?
But you met him before, you had met him before the election.
Yes.
At one of those monster fundraising events that he had.
With all four of us in the room. And so.
Sorry, Mayor.
They got bigger after he won.
A little bit.
Always do.
But yeah, I mean, so no, we had no relationship of consequence before. And really, I think that's one of the remarkable things. You're a historian. You look back in time on, at least in modern politics, you'd be hard pressed to find a candidate who doesn't have a close friend or a former business partner or somebody that they've spent a significant amount of time in their lives with at their side at some level in the organization. But he didn't. He had an entire staff of virtual strangers.
No, he didn't. And
one exception would be John Cochran, who was there during the campaign. But outside
and Walker,
of that,
because Kyle Walker was at he was at county party and then was one of the deputies at DPW. But I joke often that politicians, successful ones, of course, have a cult. This cult of people who are connected to them, and it's not pejorative, right? It's
no
Daniels has a cult, and Bai has a cult, and Peterson does, and there's the Ballard cult, which there's like three of us. It's not very far reaching.
Well, but I would argue to go back to the point question. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No,
you're... I would argue, and it's one of the things that I loved about that job. I would argue that only at the local level, only at the we can talk about the role of being deputy mayor and all that sort of stuff. But only at the municipal level of government is that opportunity possible, because you run for elections and, you know, the issues become partisan for whatever the period of that election time is. I haven't figured out when it starts here in Indianapolis yet, but this year. But and then it's streets and safety, and you know the I have yet to meet a candidate for public office that is pro crime, right? and so it the job, the day after the election, the job ceases becoming political.
Yeah. It's interesting. That's the, so I reached out to Michael early on in my tenure there, and we had this very conversation. It's like, you know, Catholics and Lutherans, right? There's only about 15 pages of doctrine that separate the two philosophies, but you know, sometimes they fight over those 15 pages pretty hard, but there was really no scientific difference between the job I did and the job that he did.
Right.
And looking back, the difference between how Greg Ballard ran the city and how Bart Peterson ran or would have run the city for another 4 years, how much difference would that have been?
What you find yourself with is problems, and you might have, if you're lucky, two or three levers to pull to deal with those problems. And it is not a Republican or Democrat decision as to which lever you pull. It is a snapshot in time in which you make an evaluation, and you're trying to guess as far down the road as you can, but the reality is you don't know what the flapping of those butterflies' wings are going to do down the road. You just hope you're making the right decision. Everybody's in there to do the right thing.
Well, and to use a word that would make P.E. McAllister proud, there's an awful lot of consanguinity when it comes to your priorities as a Republican and yours as a Democrat in an urban setting.
Could you use that word in a sentence, please?
I just did.
I think that's right. And P.E. is a good example of why I think, and again, I only know what Indianapolis is like, but why I think that job is different. You know, the benefit I bring to this discussion and to a lot of discussions I have is, you know, if you follow my career trajectory, you know, I went from state, I actually went from congressional to state to federal to local to now school board, where I've determined my next stop is the condo board at Del Boca Vista.
Phase three.
But that you know, we all know P.E. McAllister's politics, but P.E. McAllister never told us no, right? That Jim Morris, we know his politics. Jim Morris never told us no. I'm not putting myself up with those two. Paul and I talked. Did I ever tell you no? Did I ever say I can't, you know, share that information? I don't know if it's this community. I don't know if it's what municipal government's like. It is again, when the election's over, it's one of the reasons why I think Indianapolis is able to, if you think about the cities we compete for the things we do. I saw the thing about the NBA All-Star game that came out yesterday. If you think about the cities we compete for or compete with for the things we do, their metropolitan areas are three times our size.
Yeah, we're right? hitting above our weight class.
And we're doing it because our history has been, when the election's over, those politics are over, and I'm going to chip in to make sure my city continues to succeed. And that's actually, again, I go back to the reason why I enjoyed my term of service in the mayor's office was because every once in a while things got political, but 90% of the time they were as apolitical as they came. Phil Borst, former president of the council, and I negotiated lots of budgets, and you know, he'd call and say, I'll do my best, Phil Borst. I've got to, tonight I'm going to have to say the following, but just so you know, and Phil, that's fine.
That's a good
whatever,
Phil Borst.
Whatever you got to do. And we would always find common ground. And it's one of the maddening parts as we look at, and I'm not talking about our city today, but as we look at politics today, that, you know, there's that hard line, either you're Democrat or Republican, and by God, I'm going to be on one side of that line and you're going to be on the other, and we just can't talk.
Well, one of the themes of this podcast, besides, there are lots of them, but one of them is chronicling the rise of Indianapolis, the growth and the transformation in the last 50 years. And we've had multiple and have others scheduled where we had Republicans and Democrats on today with Paul Okeson and Mike O'Connor. We had John Mutz and Louis Mahern on together. We've had Mike McDaniel and Robin Winston on together, Jim Kittle and Ed Tracy. We've got more coming because it is unique to our experience that the door shuts and the white noise ends and you walk out of a room with solutions that wouldn't be possible if people were only considering their own narrow interests.
You know, that's exactly right. I think about charter schools. You know, Mayor Ballard immediately acknowledged all the good work that his predecessor did, that Mayor Peterson put forth in charter schools, and vowed to continue that. Our own efforts at the Super Bowl, you know, obviously Mark Miles was a huge win for us to get him to help lead that charge. But a lot of the infrastructure and the rest of the team were many of the same people that went after that same endeavor under the Peterson administration.
Jack
Swarbrick. I mean, yeah, there was a significant number of folks. Matt Gutwein.
I want to point out, you know,
running Health and Hospital.
There's you and I, and then you think of Mark Miles, Jack Swarbrick, and Fred Glass. You know, one is running the Holman Corporation.
Right.
One is the athletic director at Notre Dame. One's the athletic director at IU. What did we do wrong?
we make a nice, honest list.
That's exactly right.
You are listening to Leaders and Legends, a podcast presented by Veteran Strategies, a local veteran public relations enterprise, and sponsored by Girl Scouts of Central Indiana, the Crown Plaza and Conference Center at Historic Union Station, and McAllister Machinery, your friendly neighborhood Caterpillar dealer. Mike, you ran the campaign in 1999 where Bart Peterson overturned 32 years of Republican rule in the city-county building. Talk to us a little bit about that campaign, because as historic as Ballard's win in 7 is, Peterson's win in 99 was the seismic change that Republicans had feared that was coming for a while.
Yeah, and it's one of those ones that it was in fact coming for a while, right? It's the thing I've learned in managing multiple campaigns is you're never as smart as people think you are when you win, and you're never as stupid as people think you are when you lose. And I have had more than my fair share of experiences on both sides of that equation. But no, it was, first of all, you didn't have an incumbent. And so it's an open seat, and it is really becomes, I think one of the benefits of that is, and one of the reasons why I really liked working for Bart was he wanted to be mayor, right? There are things he wanted to do. There are things he wanted to get done. Your point about charter schools being one of them. He had a almost antithetical thought. It wasn't as antithetical then as it is today within the Democratic Party to say, we need to do some things to disrupt what's going on in the education world, and charter schools are one of them. And had the courage to take that on.
Would be a bold move today.
Yeah, it would be a bold move. I'm not sure it'd be possible.
And Ballard
today
praised Peterson in their debates in 07 mm-hmm. directly, said, I'm a big supporter of what you're doing.
But it was, we weren't supposed to win. So when you're not supposed to win.
So wait a second. You think in 99, so 95, Goldsmith beats Z. May Jemison in a half-hearted race. And a lot of people have said that.
He's going to debunk how brilliant I was in 99.
No. I'm going to say the opposite. And that is.
Sue Ann?
It was Sue Ann Gilroy was the Republican nominee, mm-hmm. historic first female Republican nominee for mayor.
She was a strong candidate.
Yeah.
Had a strong resume, a Lugar background. She was Secretary of State. Again, we can't get away from that office. But in 95, Goldsmith.
Only office where all you need to do is run for something else full time.
Goldsmith beats Z. May Jemison.
Don't take that seriously, Connie. I didn't mean it that way.
Or anyone else who wants to run. But I had heard before that because that race was closer than expected, either because people thought Goldsmith was going to run for governor in 96, they weren't voting for him anyway. Mm-hmm. But people had said that's when Democrats started to think, okay, and that you could turn the mayor's office. But in 99, the Peterson campaign, and I was just out of graduate school, but I remember reading, it was almost universally praised as a significant, very sharp, very smart campaign focused on ideas, and that's really emblematic with the Peterson plan.
Yeah, I think it's a couple of things. You guys are probably both too young to remember a guy named Bill Schreiber. Bill Schreiber ran for mayor of Indianapolis in 69, one of the in the earlier, late '60s, early '70s. And was a real number cruncher. Was Mike Phillips chief of staff when Mike Phillips was Speaker of the House, and looked at, movements of populations within Marion County and the impact of UniGov and when the impact of UniGov would be dissipated by people moving out of Marion County to the surrounding counties. And he always said it looked to him like it would be the early 2000s when Marion County would probably turn Democratic. So when I say we weren't supposed to win, a lot of people thought we were one cycle ahead of time. You had two people who worked in the Bayh administration, but Bart really came out of the corporate world. And so was very, very plan oriented, right? You've got the budget plan, you've got the business plan, you stick to the plan. We knew how much money we could raise. And we knew, you know, sort of the business community who had typically voted Republican and supported Republicans in Marion County, you know, looked at a Bart Peterson and said, hey, you know, if we're going to get a Democrat, we could do a lot worse than that.
And his father was a very prominent businessman.
And so, like I said, we weren't running against an incumbent who we had to define or anything like that. We were running in an open seat, and we did what our consultant said was absolutely crazy, which was then begin to put ideas down, including charter schools, about what it is he wanted to do, right? 200 more police officers for the Indianapolis Police Department force, charter schools, neighborhood divisions focused on infrastructure, all these sort of things, but we put it on paper. And a former political reporter for one of the TV stations said, when we put out the Peterson plan and we talked about investments we wanted to make in the city and where we would spend money and how we would do 200 police officers without a tax increase and all these sort of things, I'm not going to pick on anybody by name, but the older establishment Republicans did a press conference and they put pig noses on. I don't know if you remember the pig nose press conference, but it was they tried to paint the Peterson plan tax and spend, you know, bringing pork home. And it was one of the sort of turning points in the campaign where it became clear the other side who couldn't make decisions quickly in the campaign because their kitchen cabinet was, you know, 35 people around the table, where the kitchen cabinet was about three or four of us, and we could do things quickly. And so it was just they didn't have ideas. Mm-hmm. Their ideas were retrospective as opposed to forward thinking. And so we were able to, and we had a plan, we stuck with it. There, you know, people throw things at you, you know, this is campaign 101. If you have a plan, you're able to do polling, you think your polling tells you what's going to move people, stick to the plan. And so we did. And it's not, you know, like I said, it's not genius. It was just biggest part of any campaign is discipline.
Yeah.
What point did you think we're going to win this?
You know, there were two points. That press conference I was referencing and then there was, as the tail end of the campaign was coming in, and the Channel 6, the ABC affiliate at the time, said we're going to offer both campaigns the opportunity to do a 30-minute spot. You know, we're going to give. You know, I mean, essentially, they didn't give it to us, but they almost gave it to us, and we made it all about the Peterson plan. And when they called and they said, you guys are going to take advantage of that 30-second spot or 30-minute spot and your opponents aren't, is when I said they ran out of money. And I don't know, and, you know, if you think about sort of the way the tables were laid in 1999, when the Democrat campaign doesn't run out of money and the Republican campaign does, that's kind of a big deal.
Pretty big indicator.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we talked about Fred Glass. Maybe the Thursday before the election, because while we felt good about things, we were all very superstitious. And so Fred, sitting around a table like this, had a conversation with Bart, and I said, you guys have got to start thinking about a transition plan. And we both put our hands over our ears and started, don't say that!
Well, we've said this before. I've said this, and it's been affirmed by other folks who've sat where you guys are sitting. Bart Peterson was a damn good mayor, and anyone who says he wasn't is either hyper partisan or just doesn't want to acknowledge the obvious. And I made that statement when Greg Ballard came on for the very first podcast, and he goes, yes, I think that's right. You look back at Peterson's time as mayor, you were there for the first term. You were there 5 years.
Which I don't even know how you do that. So
one ulcer.
How many kids?
Two kids.
What are you most proud of when, because this is, goes back to something that Paul mentioned, former deputy mayor Joe Loftus under Steve Goldsmith, who's a friend of all of us. And he talked about being at different places in the city and being able to point to something and saying, I was in the room when that was decided, or I helped make that happen. When you think of that, you drive around the city. What do you look at when you look at both the time you were there and Peterson's 8 years as mayor and go, this was impactful, and on?
Well, before I say that, I want to do two things. Because you talked about Bart was a very good mayor, and I believe firmly he was a very, very good mayor. Indianapolis has been blessed by a series of very, very good mayors of both parties. Greg Ballard was an unknown when he came in, and everybody wondered, how would he do? And I think he is a testimony to Indianapolis has been blessed, because I think he was also a very good mayor.
No one defied expectations as much as Greg Ballard did.
Conversely, we had a transition period post-election, and Mayor Goldsmith, if there's a textbook to be written about how you ought to treat the person who's coming in behind you during your transition, Mayor Goldsmith needs to write it, because I can't think of anything we asked for that he didn't provide, and there's a few things we didn't ask for that he did provide. He ran that transition textbook to make sure everything that was going on in the city was translated to us and handed off to us in good form. And a couple of things he handed off to us, he said, we're at a point where you may want to undo this decision. And where the Conrad is today is one of those things where we undid that decision. That was scheduled to be a two-story bookstore.
Really?
Yes.
No penthouses?
No, not at the time, although they are nice. So then to answer the actual question you asked, I would tell you, I could point to Lucas Oil Stadium. Mm-hmm. I could point to not just Lucas Oil Stadium, but you forget about it when you've walked away from it, but this sort of year to year, are we or aren't we going to keep the Colts? We are on the very smallish side. Size of an NFL city. You know, Green Bay's smaller than us, but they're different.
Emerging market is a charitable description.
Yes. Right? Creating a strong foundation, right? As the campaign manager who wasn't working in the mayor's office at the time when he decided to go ahead and do a tax increase for public safety, where I was sitting at the table saying that's a crazy thing to do in an election year, it was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And I don't, the undercurrent of that, but from where I sit today, which I can't not sit where I sit today, I think the most important thing is creating an ecosystem where education, public education, an urban education system can thrive, allowing competition where competition is necessary to up everybody's game, but then creating this charter network that has created an entrepreneurial thought in the education world that is not going on anywhere else
in
the country. When I look back.
And both our podcasts with David Harris, who was the charter school guru, we'll say that as a compliment, and the one we did with the Mind Trust with Brandon Brown, who was one of Mayor Ballard's charter school gurus, and Shannon Williams, who used to edit The Recorder. They said the same thing, like, what's happening here isn't happening at every major city. It's not like 35 cities or 32 cities have pro teams and they have all these sorts of things, that Indianapolis really is sui generis and people are looking at Indianapolis to figure out how to do it. Paul, what would you say, because I specifically want to ask you about the Super Bowl and your role on the Super Bowl committee, but what would you say would be one or two things that when you're driving around or you read the newspaper, you're like, you know what? We did that.
Yeah. Unlike Mike, I was there for the first full 2 years of his first term and left. And of course, the Hotel California rule was in play. And so you can check out, but you can't leave. So I went over to the CIB and worked on the Pacers negotiation at that time. But, you know, maybe you would agree or disagree. I'm trying to think back of what those first 2 years in Bart's term were like. But, man, you're playing a lot of setting the table and a lot of defense in those first 2 years. I mean, and you got to remember what the economy was like when we took office. I mean, it was pretty far down towards the bottom.
Well, let me ask you this question, because we're honest and comfortable and nice on the Leaders and Legends podcast. A lot of the emails I received when I was went to go work for the transition team, Ballard wins on Tuesday, I start working for the transition team on Thursday, mm-hmm. are basically, this guy's going to destroy everything. He doesn't know who is this guy? He's going to undo all the good things. I mean, there was a hill to climb for Greg Ballard in the advocacy for him and for his administration that I think, quite frankly, that the Peterson folks didn't have. We had to convince people, no, this guy's like actually the mayor. Like, this isn't Dallas. You didn't have you didn't step out of the shower. This guy is actually the mayor of Indianapolis. What were some of those conversations like?
Yeah, there was a lot of natural inquisitiveness. There's a lot of incredulity about him being there. And, you know, I think we had to establish early on what were going to be some sort of key thematic guideposts that drove the administration. And, you know, certainly fiscal responsibility was a must.
And what was job one?
Public safety. And, you know, just kind of trying to restore some semblance of order. You know, you can't really control the economy in your municipality. I mean, you can influence it to an extent with certain public works projects and move things along, which I will say, through the past four decades, Indianapolis has mastered the art of getting through the tough times, mm-hmm. And knowing with public assistance when to put certain things out onto the street. But, you know, that was a time when sureties were being called into question and pulled down on the CIB. So that created structural deficit challenges. We played a lot of defense in those early months. And, you know, I think going over to the State House and voting on property tax caps, you know, that wasn't something that gained him political popularity within the other 119 municipalities in the state, right? And I think he was one of only two mayors that went over there and testified in support of it. But just as Mike referenced, you know, Bart raising taxes in election year was the right thing to do. It wasn't maybe the politically expedient thing to do, but Mayor Ballard's guidepost was, you know, people have to be able to afford to live in this county. And if they can't, a lot of these other problems get a lot worse. And yeah, I know it's kind of, you know, cutting off our own fingers budget-wise, but this is the right thing to do for people who lived here. And he stuck by that, and he got grilled over at the State House.
You mentioned the first few years were defense. When did it become not so defensive?
Right when I left.
Coincidentally.
Yeah.
Everywhere I leave, it gets better.
But I want to, you know, sort of, this is like the debate where you ask your somebody standing across the table from you to say something nice about the person over there, which is really hard for me to do with you, Paul. But no, I
remember editing the joint op-ed you guys submitted to the Star on City Time, by the way. Sorry, taxpayers.
One of the things, if you think about sort of that atmosphere you guys were describing, which I didn't, you know, I had a different perspective looking into that. But, you know, if you think about the challenge of people saying that about you when you just got elected, right? You won the vote. Unlike the guy sitting in Washington, D.C. today, Mayor Ballard won the popular vote. and what he didn't do, and I think it's courageous, he didn't fix what wasn't broken. And my guess is there was a lot of desire among certain segments of his supporters to fix what wasn't broken. The second thing I will tell you, and I deal with it every day here, and it's something we cared about. This was second term; you were gone, probably why it was successful. But when we're dealing with an uptick in crime, and the crime fighting sort of this, we're gonna use these dollars in initiatives to work against crime. And he was very committed to early childhood education. Mm-hmm. And I would argue that without Mayor Ballard's support in Indianapolis for early childhood education, to get Republicans on the council to get something done, we wouldn't have a statewide On My Way pre-K program.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. I do think, you know, probably the biggest challenge for Greg Ballard was how to be comfortable with his own skin. You know, there's this longstanding history of going to these certain events and these certain luncheons, and he felt a little bit like, what about all the neighborhood people out there who don't get that kind of time? You know, and probably the best compliment I had paid to him, to me, was, and I can't remember who the woman's name, but he stayed at an event until it was over. And she said, you know, first of all, I don't think we've had a mayor here ever. Second of all, he stayed the whole time and he had to be bored out of his mind, but he didn't leave. He made us feel important. And, you know, I don't know if he understood what our issues were. I don't know if he was listening, but just his presence and his wife, Winnie, you know, they stayed for this entire 3.5 hour event until, you know, and Mayor Ballard, it hit 9 o'clock at night and he was ready for bed. I mean, he was not a late to bed guy. But, you know, those are the things I think that helped him establish himself as someone who, you know, call him the accidental mayor that first term. He had all kinds of nicknames, but I think the more of that he did started to really ground him in a base of folks in Indianapolis that got to see their mayor in a different way. And it gave him a different kind of credibility.
And that turns you, in your mind, turned things around.
It started to. And I think to Michael's point, we didn't spend a lot of time dealing with things that didn't need to be dealt with just for the sake of dealing with them. Right. It wasn't about tearing up toys. It was about just getting, I mean, we had that, the economy really tripled down on a lot of different issues, right? Your revenue growth was horrible. Mm-hmm. You'd just gone in and sold property tax caps. Surety companies are falling under credit assassination, right? And so they're telling you, well, stuff rolls downhill. Sorry, you got to come up with another $27 million mm-hmm. to buy. Right? And we don't have $27 million, right? And so we were forced to rework things, the agreement with the EPA. We were desperate to find new ways to make things more affordable. And it was by nobody's manufacture other than the fact that, boy, when you're not pulling in revenues and the economy's in the doghouse, you know, you're just, it doesn't, again, it goes back to, it wouldn't matter if we were Republican or Democrat. You were just fighting to keep your fingers in the holes and keep the thing moving.
And when the economy tanks nationally like it did, the municipal governments feel it first. And the hardest.
And the longest.
And the longest, that's right, yeah.
I think that's the hard, I've always said, I think the hardest job in politics, all due respect to those in federal office, but I think the hardest job in politics is being mayor of a mid to major city in the United States.
Yeah.
The first big decision, I think that's a fair statement, so correct me if you think it isn't, that Greg Ballard made was to decide to resubmit to host the Super Bowl. There was a lot of talk about would we or wouldn't we during the transition, and we shoved it all off because it just wasn't the time, right, to make that decision. The Super Bowl was pursued first by the administration of Bart Peterson. Mike, you weren't there, but I'm sure you were involved somehow, some way. We mentioned Fred Glass before. We'd love to have you on the podcast, Fred. And he was very involved in that. And I remember, I think it was the summer of 2007, when the bid, Indianapolis did not get selected, lost to Dallas.
Yeah, it was.
I think it was the summer of 2007 because Murray Clark, my boss at the Indiana Republican Party, I suggested that we issue a statement saying, you know, great job, maybe next time kind of thing. And I got some grief from some friends of mine at the Marion County Republican Party. We thought it was the right thing to do in the spirit of kind of what we're talking about generally. But Greg Ballard did decide to go after the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
You were chief of staff when that's happening, when that decision's made. Paul, talk a little bit about not only the decision to do it, mm-hmm. but also the feeling when it was awarded. I was not in the administration then.
Yeah.
I was at Scheel.
So Mayor Ballard came into my office and he sat down. I can't remember the date, but he just said, hey, you know, I got to do this thing called mayor, but we're going to go after the Super Bowl. I want you to sit on the committee and we need to figure out who we're going to get to help us. And I don't remember the genesis of Mark Miles' name, but it came up pretty quick. And he
was active during the transition.
Ubiquitously well received. Everyone was like, oh, yeah, that's the guy, right? Yeah. And I think his decision was, I think it's pretty well understood. I can say this with confidence that first go around Indianapolis was robbed, right? Some agreements that were well understood and that were not kept. People didn't hold up their end of the bargain, and I won't go any further than that. But I think we understood.
Not
that,
local people, by the way. Yeah. We're not good pointing point. Fingers these are, at anybody locally.
Folks in Indy, they stay with it, and we stayed with our end of the bargain, and some other parties involved in that didn't. that was encouraging, right? Because we felt like, hey, you know, we honestly won that thing and you're going to give it to us. But
and you lost to Dallas and Jerry Jones and the biggest stadium in the NFL. So it's not like you lost to, you know, the Washington Generals.
Right. Exactly. And I think that it was a pretty easy decision for us to want to go after it again. But the roadmap had been built.
Right.
And I think the right thing to do to make a positive comment about their effort is it's not the administration's responsibility to bring. I mean, we facilitate, right? We do think, hey, they don't pay hotel taxes. That we'll put an ordinance in. We'll take care of it, right? You got to open up public safety and streets and thoroughfares. We'll do that too. We got you covered, right? Those are the things we do to facilitate the undergirding of what the corporate community. The Indiana Sports Corp, those organizations that pull together, and I think we each had to raise, there was a $25 million commitment to go after the Super Bowl, and both times, under both Peterson and Ballard, Indianapolis was the only city vying for the Super Bowl that had its $25 million raised and committed prior to submitting the bid. And if that doesn't tell you what kind of city we live in, to not only do it once, but to do it twice, right? To say, our chips are in the table already. We're ready to go.
And what are the odds that 99% of the people who supported the bid under a Democrat mayor also supported the bid under the Republican mayor?
Yeah, I mean, again, we took that same strategy, and I know that everybody felt the sense of connectedness between the two, right? This really felt very similar. I will say that there were a couple of interesting stories. We had a quote in our bid, Jim Nance, right? So Jim Nance makes a quote for us.
The CBS broadcaster?
Yeah. And but he's from Houston. And 30 minutes before, maybe an hour before we're in to go give our presentation, with this baked into our video, we get a knock on the door, and the NFL tells Jack and Mark, like, you got to take it out.
Mark Miles and Jack Swarbrick.
Yeah. And they're, of course, what do you mean we got to take it out? It's in our presentation. We're up in like an hour. And they're like, you got to take it out. Houston said you can't do it. So
Houston, which had already had the Super Bowl prior.
But I will tell you, just like the community comes together and gets things done, that room huddled together real quick. And I'm trying to remember the video guy's name. Conrad Piccirillo gets his, you know, MacBook out and reorchestrates this entire presentation so that it edits that out seamlessly. And of course, we go in there and it's announced sometime later in Atlanta when we won. And I was fortunate enough to be on the plane ride back with Jim Irsay, Mark Miles, the entire squad. He flew us back from Atlanta. And the elation that was felt is almost indescribable, really. I mean, it was a really cool thing that for decades we had really intentionally become the sports capital of the world. And this is the creme de la creme.
This culmination.
This is the big thing,
yeah,
right? Absolutely. And to be able to pull it off. But the only thing that really tops that in my mind is what the reaction was after the game. The video and all of the testimonials, everybody in the NFL, 201, not all of them publicly, but 201 privately or publicly said, absolutely the best run Super Bowl in NFL history.
Well, if I was going to throw a party, I'd want Allison Melangdon to run it.
You ever want the salty version of what Paul was referencing to what happened in the year prior? You should have Bill Polian on the show, but you'll have to beat it a lot.
Mr. Polian on the show, but a lot of the same people who were in the room when Mayor Peterson went after it were the same people in the room. There was no, well, I'm not going to help you because I was on Bart's team and we didn't get it, so we're not going to give you this, you know, huge gift, right, or win. I'm going to say something that could be wrong, eek, but I wrote the plaque. So all the mayors in the city county building have a plaque. And I remember being the Republican representative to Bart Peterson's plaque and bust being unveiled. Talk about the skunk at the party. Gee, this was right after Ballard won. I'm like, and I went up, and Mike, of course, Mike O'Connor was very friendly to me, and we wanted to do it in a spirit of bipartisanship. But I wrote the plaque for Ballard for his bust at the city county building. I have to think again, I don't believe it mentions the Super Bowl. He never considered that one of his big, giant accomplishments.
Yeah, because it really, and he's right, it's his humble nature anyway, but It it's not something that, again, the administration doesn't, we have to advance it and sort of be the convening authority to help get the ball rolling. But it is the community. It is the corporate community, the nonprofit community. It is just individual leaders. It is the fact that we have the sports corporation that we do that is really still kind of setting the standard for those organizations nationally. It's all of that that makes those things happen. And I think he's absolutely right. It's not something that we did, but we sure as heck made sure the city was ready, and we threw a hell of a party.
Did you, either of you, go to the Super Bowl or both?
I did not attend the inside of the game. My best friend was in town from Scottsdale, and I chose to just walk the perimeter. I wanted to see what happened in the rest of that city. It was a gorgeous day. It was like 55 degrees. It was sunny. It was an amazing day. I chose not. I gave my tickets away. I chose not to go inside. I wanted to just kind of see how we operated.
I went.
I gave my tickets to Mike.
No, it was fun. You know, it's the interesting part about that, all that is, if there's ever another Super Bowl here, I won't. I've been there, but I would probably do what you did, which is, you know, the game. I would never want to offend the NFL and say the game doesn't matter, but in when it's your city, the game matters a lot less than everything leading up to it. And I think that Paul's point is, when I talk to people in the work that I do now about that Super Bowl, hands down, everybody, you know, there's a class of people that go to every Super Bowl. And they have all said, oh, it was the best one we've ever been to. One, because we got to our hotel and we never had to drive anywhere.
Yeah.
And then two, you know, God blessed us with great weather. Almost too nice weather, if you remember that Friday night of Super Bowl weekend when there was just too many people in downtown.
Georgia Street, yeah.
Yeah, Georgia Street became sort of the, we need to evacuate people. But it was just a combination of everything. And I think actually for posterity's sake, for Indianapolis, maybe the way all this played out so that it wasn't Bart Peterson's Super Bowl or it wasn't Greg Ballard's Super Bowl, it was Indianapolis' Super Bowl.
That's absolutely
is
right.
Kind of the right way for it to transpire.
And either of you want to take a chance now, a free shot at Dallas for getting the Super Bowl and then suffering an ice storm that year?
Well, they learned that you can't use sand to pick up snow. They learned some hard lessons about temporary seating. And it's those kind of things that make the statements we're making absolutely true. The people that worked at Lucas Oil Stadium, all the volunteers, and just the people who came, his point about Georgia Street, they had a helicopter up in the air. Georgia Street was literally building to building, locked in. I mean, and not a single serious injury came out of that.
Right.
And I mean, that's Hoosier Hospitality and the kind of people that attend the game, the people that live here, just...
Well, and the people
it makes it special.
And the people that... You know, wear badges that are looking at this in a room that isn't anywhere near where they are, and they say, "Hey, people are beginning." You know, I've looked in the eyeballs of a few of the folks that are in this crowd. They're getting uncomfortable. We need to, you know, I'm not going to name names, but we all know who those folks are. That their participation in a very important community event is doing the job that they do. And I remember because I was working on that crew. It was sort of the we need to get the gates out of the way. We need to get people out of that.
Give them some release valves.
Yeah.
Greg Ballard used to walk into my office, and if there were people in the office, he would say, "Everyone get out. I need to talk to my political hack." He didn't mean it as a compliment. I took it as a compliment. Mike, given your considerable political background, did you consider yourself Bart Peterson's political hack?
You've probably heard me reference myself as a political hack. Yeah, it's the, you know, there's a skill set that comes from having been a political hack. One, it is evaluating a situation and making a decision, sometimes right, sometimes wrong, but you're able to make a decision pretty quickly. And I know in today's world, political hack is a bad moniker, but no, I'm happy to have had the set of experiences that I have had.
It's a political office.
But even I'm not in a political office today. The work I do in the school board, my experience as a political hack helps me almost every day.
Mm-hmm. I've talked to several students in classes and, you know, we all have spoken in front of people about our experiences or whatever. Before we get to the five questions, as we end all the podcasts with the same five questions, how much did being involved in politics, not government, in politics – change your life, give you a set of friends you wouldn't have, give you a sense of pride, that sort of thing? Mike and then Paul.
Well, I think part of it is you are surrounded by a bunch of people that you have a common set of experiences with. And it's funny, I was, because of an unusual set of circumstances, I was in a room with somebody who I worked with in the Secretary of State's office 20, 35 years ago, whatever that was.
You were only five.
And,
you got
and,
a full head of hair.
And I haven't seen them for 20 years. And it was, you know, we picked up like
old home week.
It was, you know, last week. And so, yeah, it's a great set of experiences.
I met you and Tom, John, and Dave Certo all at one of the very first functions of Downtown GOP Club, what used to be BW3s is where we used to have it. And all three of you, I still consider very dear friends. Tom has been a friend to me in ways I couldn't even share on a podcast over the years, as have you. I just saw Judge Certo not recently, or not too long ago, and we probably haven't seen each other in a couple of years, but it's, you know, you look into the eyes of someone you can truly call a friend. I wouldn't replace those experiences or those relationships for anything.
And how much would your life experiences and friendships and sense of friendship be diminished if you were only friends with people who voted like you do?
Well, you know, I have told you before, I'm really the Republican on the Annapolis Public School Board. and to those of you who don't know me, I'm very much a Democrat. But no, it's the, you know, I don't know if you saw what Ellen said, Ellen DeGeneres said on the, you know, if you limit yourself to people who think, act, talk, look like you, you're missing out on so much. And so most of the fun I have on any given day is making fun of my friends who vote differently than me. But I've found with any number of very active Republicans that I work with on a regular basis, some of whom are very, very good friends, that when you get down to the brass tacks, we have a lot more in common than we have in different.
Yeah. I couldn't say any better than that.
You're listening to Leaders and Legends, a podcast presented by Veteran Strategies, a local veteran public relations enterprise, and sponsored by Girl Scouts of Central Indiana, the Crown Plaza at Historic Union Station and Conference Hall, and McAllister Machinery, your friendly neighborhood Caterpillar dealer. We are at the five questions portion of the Leaders and Legends podcast. Are you ready?
I was told there'd be no math.
Well, Chevy, get ready. We'll have Mike answer all these questions first. And we'll go Mike, Paul.
Okay.
Mike, what was your first job?
First paying job or first job as a out of college?
First job you actually reported your taxes to government.
Eli Lilly.
The Greenfield Wastewater Treatment Plant.
Paul, can you top that?
Can he add? I want to know what the job was. What did you do there?
Human beings are no longer allowed to do the job that I did at the Greenfield Wastewater Treatment Plant, which might explain why I'm so short.
Oh, and he glows in the dark. My first real job, I guess, was, I mowed yards growing up, and I did work construction a summer for my dad's company out in the field, but my first real job was, I worked full time to help pay for college at Walmart, Sam's Club, Walmart Stores, Inc.
Mike, what was your first concert?
Bachman Turner Overdrive with my oldest brother.
Year?
Oh, I can't remember that. 77, 78.
Who was the opening act?
Oh, man. I remember Bachman Turner Overdrive. You think I can remember the opening act of that?
Bob Seger being in town, my brother who's 58. How old are you, Mike? 56?
56.
He remembers seeing Uriah Heep, and he goes, and the opening act was Kiss, and no one had ever heard of him. Then the next year, Kiss explodes. Kiss comes back. They're the headline act. He goes, and the opening act was someone no one had ever heard of, Bob Seger. And he goes, it's amazing how many times the opening act comes back and hits it big. Paul, what was your first concert?
It was Tesla. Yeah, I was, and still am a little bit.
And that's not a battery powered car.
No, that's an in-home. I'm a bit of a headbanger and always have been. But yeah, it was my first concert.
Mike, if you could suggest any book for someone to read, which book would you choose?
The for those of us who care about the things, you know, whether they be our vocation or avocation now, there's a great book called The Founding, and it is actually about the period in between the Articles of Confederation and the Constitution. You know, the sort of centralization of power, and even itself, the book is not that great. It's the end of the book where they talk about the individuals who participated in the Constitutional Convention, and the moral of that is that each of them were radicals. Many of them died, you know, like being stabbed by their lover's angry husband or whatever. This country we belong to started off as a radical experiment.
Well, like, was it Burr and Hamilton that had the duel?
Yes. No. Yeah. Yeah.
They 10 were crazy, and
they
shoot.
Were crazy people.
Mm-hmm. there'd be a couple. I would say probably the one that touched me the most, and it's been a while since I picked it up, but was Citizen Soldier by Stephen Ambrose, which is a compilation of a lot of the letters from World War II veterans and just a sort of a repainting of history through those letters and through those interviews. And my dad was a Korean War vet, and it's a book that just came out right around the time I think maybe Saving Private Ryan did, or not too long after. And so you'll have a deeper appreciation for what those people sacrificed and what that was really like for them, those experiences. It's worth a read.
Mike, if you could witness any event in history, be there as it happens, witness it with your own eyes, which event would you choose?
That's hard. And we're going to run out of time, right?
Plenty of time.
I think, like to be there when World War II ended.
So on the battleship Missouri in September 45?
Yeah, when you say witness, or in New York or in Philadelphia or in your reference to that book, and I have uncles who fought in combat in World War II, and it was a seminal event of their life. Mm-hmm. And just sort of that, you know, we think about battle engagements today and people will lose their lives. I'm not diminishing the importance of the sacrifices our soldiers make today, but the outcome is never really in question. The outcome of World War II was in question for a very long time. And you think about what the world would look like today.
Paul?
What was the question again?
Witness any event in history.
Who was it that was it Sumter that got beat with the cane in session?
Charles Sumner.
Yeah, Sumner.
By Bully Brooks.
Was it Brooks or Preston was it Mary? Brooks. It was a Webster.
No, it was Bully Brooks because Sumner had insulted his uncle, who was a senator.
Yeah.
Andrew Butler was his cousin, who was a senator.
And he runs across the floor with his cane and just
beats him
living
in the chamber.
Yeah. I mean,
those are the good old days.
Speaking of political hackery.
People talk about divisiveness. I think that's pretty No, I think those moments in history, like we think back upon those times, like people were much more civil in our sort of, you know, colored overview of history sometimes, and to know that people were just as crazy back then as we are today, I think those kind of events, that'd be great to go see that. I mean, just to be sitting there and watch this guy's coming over with a cane, look out!
Just over slavery.
Yeah.
You're so passionate about preserving slavery that you would basically almost... Sumner couldn't come back to the Senate for 2 years.
Yeah.
Last question. If you could have dinner with anyone living today, 2 hours off the record, whom would you choose, Mike?
I'm going to stay local. I would like to have 2 hours with Lee Hamilton.
You know him, I would assume.
I do, yeah. You take for granted the people that you know. And as I watch my parents age, the knowledge that he has, and I would like to spend 2 hours uninterrupted with Lee Hamilton to get his perspective on the world today.
Well, he'd be a dream podcast
guest. Oh, yeah.
I'd love to have him on. Brilliant. Paul?
I'd really like to have 2 hours with George Bush, with W. I mean, to talk about
post
9/11 and just, you know, did you go to the event where he, and Ballard was there, he came out to the, was it the convention center?
When he went to the fairgrounds?
And he introduced, and he talked about Ballard and he made an introduction. I don't remember if this was for Holcomb or who this was for, but that was the first time I really saw him not on camera, right? And unscripted. And he just seems like such a really funny guy, like a very self-effacing, you know,
he's a first-class history nut too.
And I think the longer history strays away from his time in office, I think the higher marks he's going to get during his time in presidency, because there was a lot of things that got, you know, glossed over based on more, you know, tumultuous events that happened in his tenure, but he had some really impressive ideas. His tax restructuring is a deal I think most people, both sides of the aisle, would take in a heartbeat today, and it got no notice given the time. But he seems like a really funny, down-to-earth guy, and I think he'd have a lot to share.
The Leaders and Legends podcast is not only to promote my company, Veteran Strategies, but it's to bring people together who get together frequently for meals, or you see each other at events or celebrations. And I can say to everyone listening that the friendship between Mike O'Connor and Paul Okeson is genuine, it's real, and it's incredibly beneficial to this city. We need more of it, not less of it. And the example set by these leaders for all of us is one to follow, and we cannot thank you enough for your time today, for coming on.
An honor to be on. Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening to Leaders and Legends, brought to you by Veteran Strategies Incorporated. If you want to contact us about this program or our menu of public relations services, please send us an email at robert@veteranstrategies.com. That's robert@veteranstrategies.com.